The Association of Classical and Christian Schools presents Repairing the Ruins, the 2010 ACCS Annual Conference, copyright 2010. If you have purchased this audio CD, you are free to make multiple copies of it for your own or your school's use. You may not sell copies of this audio or post it on the Internet. If you would like to find out more about the work of ACCS, please visit our website at www.accsedu.org. To order additional talks from this conference, please visit the ACCS website and click on Conferences. Thank you for your support of ACCS.
All right, well, good morning. My name is Mike McKenna. I'm the headmaster at Rockbridge Academy, and this is the presentation on conducting a grand tour at your school. If that's something you're interested in, just in case you're in the wrong room, you might want to change places right now. Let's go ahead and pray together before we get started. Our kind Father, thank you for your grace and mercy towards us in Christ and in Providence. We thank you for the glory of your creation and that you have granted us permission to know you as the Creator. We pray that you would guide and bless our discussion, and as this conference wraps up, that you would protect our travels home to various parts of the corners of this earth. For it's in Christ's name that we pray. Amen. Well, we just got back from our grand tour this last Wednesday night. Wednesday morning, we were in Venice. Wednesday night, we got home to Washington, D.C., and then Thursday morning, Ralph Janikowski and I grabbed a plane at 6:30 in the morning to come here. So I'm still on some different wobbly time frame and haven't quite gotten caught up. So if my knees buckle under me while we're talking this morning, you'll forgive me. William Blake, the English artist and poet, once said that traveling abroad is a progressive exercise in the discovery of our own ignorance. As classical educators, we agree that learning is to be a lifelong exercise, and that the more we learn, the more we realize we don't know. So it's my position that we have to recapture the vision for travel as an indispensable tool of truly classical learning. As travel, more than mere book learning, shows us how little we really know, and by doing so, helps us to become truly wise. Before we get into the details of how we conduct our grand tour and how we fund it, which I know is particularly interesting to everybody, I'd like to give you a little background on the history of the grand tour. Beginning in the late 16th century, it became fashionable for young aristocrats to visit Paris, Venice, Florence, Rome, and other regions around the Mediterranean as a culmination of their classical education. And thus was born the idea of the Grand Tour, a practice which introduced Englishmen, Germans, Scandinavians, and eventually Americans to the art and culture of Western civilization for the next 300 years. During the 18th century, the Grand Tourist was typically a young man with a thorough grounding in Greek and Latin literature, as well as some leisure time, some means, and some interest in art and architecture. The Grand Tour could last anywhere from several months to several years, and most Grand Tourists were accompanied by a teacher or a guardian and were expected to return home with souvenirs of their travels as well as an enlarged understanding of art and architecture formed by exposure to great masterpieces and a broadened perspective on culture, government, and history. When I mention souvenirs, I don't mean trinkets and Greece T-shirts. I mean busts of Roman and Greek antiquity, actual treasures of art. The culmination of the Grand Tour during this time was Italy, with its heritage of ancient Roman monuments, its history of medieval theology, its birthplace of the Renaissance, its central role in the Baroque. And so Italy was considered to be the final destination of the Grand Tour. Late 18th century taste revered the art of the ancient Romans. The British in particular were lured to Italy by their admiration of antiquity and their desire to see firsthand such monuments of ancient civilization as the Colosseum in Rome and such wonders of nature as the eruptions of Mount Vesuvius near Naples. The advantage of Italy meant the furthering of one's education, the acquisition of intellectual and cultural knowledge that was an integral part of the upbringing of the classically educated. Coined by Richard Lascelles in his 1670 work, The Voyage of Italy, the term Grand Tour came to refer to travel of Europe's elite to France, Switzerland, and the South, and was unarguably educational in character. The Grand Tour typically started at about age 20, since by then the traveler would have acquired a sound basis in classical history and literature. Many travelers were older, but all shared this classical background, and as a result, their imaginations were already well prepared long before they set foot on foreign soil. This is one of the reasons why field trips and travel as tools of learning are so vital in the education of our students. By the late 19th century, the Grand Tour had become an essentially American phenomenon. Not surprisingly, this group of newly wealthy citizens of a relatively young country found context and meaning for their lives by thinking of themselves as heirs of the great Western tradition. They traced their cultural lineage from the Greeks through the Roman Empire to the European Renaissance, and particularly the Venetian Renaissance. During the Gilded Age, America's upper classes and merchant classes traveled the world, visiting the great European cities and the ancient sites of the Mediterranean, collecting and honoring their Western cultural heritage. The example of Venice's democratic society of well-to-do merchants and traders who collected the world's wealth, loved architecture, and enjoyed a strong sense of public responsibility appealed to these Americans on the basis that it was both what they were becoming and what they aspired to be. In 1867, Mark Twain took a grand tour to Europe and the Eastern Mediterranean, and later his dispatches were published as a book, The Innocents Abroad or The New Pilgrim's Progress. Within its first year, the book sold over 70,000 copies and remained the best-selling of Twain's books throughout his lifetime. By the 1960s, the Grand Tour had been introduced or adopted in a less formal fashion by college students worldwide who purchased round-the-world airline tickets, Euro passes, and set off to stay in youth hostels the world over. At Rockbridge, we include field trips in our curriculum because we believe that to read about something is one thing, but to go and experience it is altogether different. Our fourth graders go to the Washington Cathedral after their study of Gothic architecture, and the National Gallery after their study of Renaissance and medieval art. Our fifth grade U.S. history students take a day trip on the Chesapeake schooner Sultana, take an overnight trip to Williamsburg. Our sixth graders travel to Gettysburg during their study of the recent unpleasantness. It's one thing to read about Pickett's charge. It's something altogether different to be a 12-year-old shouting the rebel yell as you march across the wheat field toward that clump of trees that was the center of the Yankee line while Ralph Janikowski, simulating cannon fire, blows a hole in your line, leaving carnage of sixth-grade boys and girls to his left and right. Book learning is a great thing to have, but the practical application of that knowledge, the kind of application that going there only provides, so powerfully fixes this learning in our minds that it's an aspect of classical education that we educators ought to be determined to recapture, to be a capstone to our students' education. All right, so let's get into some of the specifics about what we at Rockbridge do. The first thing we make sure our students understand is that this is not a vacation. This is education. They are to be actively engaged in the learning that they'll be experiencing. The dirty little secret is they're going to have the most wonderful time of their lives, but that's not the purpose. That's one of the net benefits. But the purpose is to learn. This is education, not vacation. So what does that educational aspect of the trip look like? Well, it requires prior research. Before our students go, each of them choose a topic of interest to them that they're going to come across, obviously, on our trip. If our itinerary includes Greece and Italy, having them research bullfights in Madrid wouldn't be very valuable since they're not going to see any. So I work with the students to make sure that we're actually going to come across the thing they want to research or the topic they want to research. They turn these papers in to me. I grade them. I provide feedback just like any other research project. And this is included in their – I teach a grand tour class, and so this is included in their grand tour class grade. Some of the projects our students researched this year prior to going were or other topics were the Arch of Titus and the Roman Forum, the Four Horses of the Basilica of St. Mark's in Venice, the Battle of Salamis, the battles of the Siege of Athens, and so on and so forth. There's just an unlimited amount of research the students can do prior. They then take that research, and when they're there, when we're driving along the coast of Salamis Bay, they present their, they are themselves a tour guide, so to speak, and they present their report on the Battle of Salamis, the Siege of Athens, the Four Horses, whatever. So they become the local, on-the-spot tour guide themselves. We also require them to journal daily. To prepare them for what a travel journal looks like, we spend a good bit of class time reading examples from Hilaire Belloc's The Path to Rome and also Mark Twain's Innocents Abroad to give them an idea of what a real travel journal is made up of. It's not just went here, saw this, did that, ate this, day two. It's an impression. It has to be a creative working out of their thoughts, their impressions. I tell them I want to see sketching. I want to read poetry. I want to see your personal retelling of an ancient myth. I want to see humor. I want to see pathos. I want it to be as creative as you can possibly make it. I tell them I want this to be something that your grandchildren fight over at the reading of your will. No, you can keep the beach house. I want Grandma's journal. Once we get back to the United States, these journals are then turned in to me 3 weeks later. I grade them, and they're included in their senior year's history grade. We have evening meetings, maybe two every 3 days. And at the evening meetings, we unpack what we've been seeing and learning. We'll talk about the biblical worldview. We'll talk about their thoughts and impressions. These evening meetings are very fluid because every year the tour guide is going to say something different. Every year the students will bring up some different aspect of what interested them. And so we'll read particular passages from Scripture that have to do with what we've seen and heard that day. And we'll talk and discuss and spend about an hour doing that. It's also a good time to get everybody dialed into what tomorrow holds while you have their captive attention. I wouldn't underestimate the value of those evening meetings, though, because it really is the time for the students and Mr. Janikowski and me as the teachers to guide their thinking and to help them focus on what the implications are of what they're seeing and reading and learning. This past grand tour, we discussed topics such as the Greek view of death after visiting the Archaeological Museum in Athens, what it means to know thyself after visiting the Temple of Apollo at Delphi, whether the catacombs are a depressing burial place or a celebration of life and why that would be so, all kinds of things. There's really no limit to the variety and number of questions you can discuss. And the kids love the give and take. They love the discussion. Sometimes we have to just shut the conversation down. No, an hour's enough. We have to get to dinner. We'll pick this up later or something like that. But usually the kids are very eager to engage in the conversation. And then they'll do oral presentations upon return. We begin discussing topics for their oral presentations while we're on the ground in Europe. So they know this is coming. They've been told this is coming last year in class. So they'll pick a topic that interested them, and they'll put together a 10 to 12 minute oral presentation on that. When we get back to school the next fall, they'll first present that to a faculty panel. We'll make recommendations for improvement, suggestions. We'll ask them questions. It's sort of like a mini thesis in that regard. They make their case, and then they are questioned on that that topic by some faculty members. We'll select the best two or three and then have those students present that in early October to the student body, or at least 7th through 12th grade. And that's a great opportunity for those students to begin feeding back enthusiasm and interest into the younger grades for when it's their turn to come on the grand tour. These are the things you're going to be able to get to experience. It's one thing if it comes from me, but when it comes from their fellow students, hey, we get to do this as students at Rockbridge Academy, that engenders a whole another level of enthusiasm and excitement. We do have a winner of these oral presentations. The winner is awarded what we call the Grand Tour Prize on our last day of school. It's a financial reward, a small financial reward. And their grade for their oral presentation is also included in their rhetoric class. So that gives you an idea of the educational requirements of the tour itself. I think the students get the message fairly quickly. This is education. It's not vacation. Well, let's talk about who goes. Seniors versus juniors. Should we take our seniors? We at Rockbridge take our juniors at the conclusion of their junior year. Some folks I've talked to want to take their seniors. The difficulty with taking the seniors after the conclusion of their senior year is that they're done. You can't get much, if any, work out of them. Your opportunity for them to bring their experiences back and invest it into the culture of the school are lost forever. And so it just doesn't make any... We can't build upon what they've seen and heard and learned. Once they've seen and heard and learned it, well, they're going to university next September. So your ability to say, hey, let's spend some opportunity throughout the course of this next year to discuss what you saw and learned is gone. So for those reasons, we take our juniors. And that gives us all the opportunity to do those things I just discussed. Parents of these juniors are highly encouraged to come. We love having the parents along. It's a great opportunity for the parents to get to know their own children in a different context and setting, but to get to know all their children's peers. We tell them, mix it up at dinner, sit with different people you don't know on the bus, and the parents. It's a wonderful opportunity for the parents to get to know all the other students in the class as well. Chaperones. We always have a female chaperone and a male and male chaperones. Our classes are right now about 25 students, and we have had three chaperones cover those. But because of the parents, we'll have about an equal number of parents and students. This year we had 25 students and 22 parents. So I'm planning on taking a fourth chaperone. Next year I'll have four chaperones for roughly 45 to 50 people. Some have asked me, what about having parents as chaperones? Our parents are selected from the faculty. And I do that on purpose. I want the chaperones to know that they work for me, that they're not on vacation either. They're actually working. So if I tell one of the chaperones, this child is sick, you have to stay behind today and stay here in the hotel with her, it's hard to say that to a parent who just shelled out $4,000 to come along on this trip. That you by the way, you don't get to go today. It's hard to do that. So I prefer to use the faculty members as chaperones for that reason, so that they know they're working for me. Secondly, don't forget, the faculty members are learning incredibly as well. And then they're going to come back and invest that in their classrooms next fall. So to be able to bless the teachers with that experience and say, now go, be warm and well-filled and invest that back into your classroom is a tremendous blessing. And we see that happen in our classrooms. So as far as chaperones go, I prefer to use our own faculty and staff rather than parent chaperones. Not the parent chaperones won't work. It's just what I prefer to do. What about other family members? I don't allow younger siblings to come along. They have to wait their turn. Okay? They have to wait their turn. But what if cousin Ed, who's a junior or a senior and will be going off to university, what if he wants to come? I will allow that. I will allow that sort of thing on a limited basis. What if grandma wants to come? I will allow that as well. Again, I want everybody to go into this fully with their eyes open. There is a lot of walking. This is not easy. This is not vacation. We're going. We're on the move. And it's hard for grandparents. I did have one couple bring their mom, her mom, And after, I think on the second day in Athens, she fell and broke her hip. And they couldn't get her back home until we got to Rome. So she was with us for about 5 days in pain and agony. And so their recommendation was that I just disallow grandparents. And I said, look, I can't exercise wisdom for everybody. You do that. You decide whether this is what you want to do, but I'll permit it. Some grandparents are in their 50s and very well able to keep up the pace, and so I don't want to limit that. I want this to be a wonderful family event, if it can be. What about other schools? When we were first starting this out, we had, our first senior class was 5 boys. Our second senior class was 4 girls. We just needed bodies to make it pay for itself. So we enlisted other schools to come along with us if they wanted to. I would caution you to do that very carefully, though. They have to be like-minded schools. Remember, this is education, not vacation, and those kids have to be bought into the model wholeheartedly, their headmasters and their parents as well. Otherwise, having a group of kids who think this is a shopping spree come along with your kids who know this is education could be really detrimental. So if you're going to allow other schools to come along with you, only select schools whom you know very well. You know the headmaster, you know the parents, you know that they're bought into the idea of the trip. All right, then you have to plan your itinerary. Where is it you want to go? Where do you want to go? Well, what do you think the main driving force of where you go ought to be? Excuse me? No, go ahead, speak up. Yes, your curriculum. What is it you study? Remember, this is learning. There ought to be a seamless integration between what you're learning in school and what you're continuing to learn on the Grand Tour. If those are two separate entities that have nothing to do with each other, you've missed the point, in my opinion. I knew of one school that said, yeah, we have a Grand Tour. We love it. Last year we went to Tokyo, and the year before that we went to New York, and the year before that we went to London. It was great. And I thought, that's not really a Grand Tour because you're just picking an exotic place and going there each year. How do you tie that into your curriculum? How do you do that? So our curriculum, you have it in one of your handouts, you have our itinerary. Our itinerary is planned that way specifically to capitalize on the flow of Western civilization from ancient Greece through to ancient Rome, through the Middle Ages of Assisi and Siena, and ending with the Renaissance and Reformation in Venice and Florence. And then we take that wonderful opportunity with our teacher chaperones and so forth and our rising seniors and feed that back into the school next year. We've had, because of things we do on the Grand Tour, we've had teachers adjust their curriculum. Well, because Savonarola is a big figure in Renaissance Florence, let's include him more significantly in the in our study of European history. Or we'll say, hey, something is important in the curriculum. Let's make sure we bring that out in the Grand Tour. And so there's a constant give and take, ebb and flow of the curriculum and the Grand Tour so that they're constantly building and capitalizing on one another. So your curriculum ought to be the driving force of where you go and what you see. As I said, have your students be guides, have them do their research prior, and then cover that on the Grand Tour. Just have them be the tour guide for the brief 10 or 15 minutes. This year, our students reported on the Holy Staircase in Rome, the staircase that Christ is reputed to have climbed in Pilate's palace on the way to his trial, that Helen, Constantine's mother, brought back to Rome. And to see the Catholic pilgrims climbing the staircase on their knees is a tremendous thing for our students to see and to grapple with theologically. And so that's a wonderful thing. They talked about, while we were standing in the marketplace in Corinth, they talked about Paul being brought before Gallio in Acts 18 and the purpose of the Bema. And she really did a great job unpacking that chapter as we were standing there in front of the Bema seat where Paul was tried. The Catacombs of San Callisto and other things. So the students really have a wonderful opportunity to be tour guides themselves. Free time. Students always want to know, what's free time like? I always put free time in quotes. Imagine taking 25 students, dropping them in the middle of Rome, and then going, okay, you're free. have fun. As I said, I put free time in quotes. What I'll do is I'll say, okay, tomorrow's free time. You have the option to go here, here, or here. Pick. There might be, you know, I might take a group to go to the Villa Borghese and see some statues and then take a brief walk after that. Ralph might take a group to a few other sites that weren't on the planned itinerary. If a mom wants to just say, hey, I'm taking my daughter and we're going shopping, that's great. That's fine. But I want to know where everybody's going and with whom they are the next morning, because it's not just sleep in, do whatever, free time. The kids will interpret free time as literally free, and I have a more strict view of what that looks like. Let's talk about hiring a professional travel arranger, tour arranger, or doing these, making these arrangements yourselves. What are some of the pros and cons of each one? The professional travel arranger, what are the pros of that? Well, they do all the work for you. You tell them where you want to go, and the next thing you know, you have an itinerary, the hotels where you'll be staying, the names of the guides who will be touring you at each individual place, and the work has been done for you. It's wonderfully easy. You may be the one actually leading the group on the ground, or the depending on the service you hire to make the plans for you, they can provide someone with you to make sure that you are getting from airport A to hotel B and so on and so forth. But all the arrangements will have been made for you if you hire a professional to do that. What are the cons? Well, I think the cons are your ability to hire your own tour guides, make sure the tour guides are approaching this tour the way you want them to approach it, is limited, because you're not the one writing the check, so to speak. The tour arranger is, and the tour guides work for the tour arranger. We've had some miserable tour guides. We've had some wonderful tour guides who are used repeatedly, and I wouldn't touch the miserable ones with a 10-foot pole, but because I'm making the arrangements, I get to call that shot. If somebody else is making the arrangements for me, I don't get to call that shot necessarily. And the tour guides are incredibly important. Also, the depending on the tour, the travel arranger you use, you might be traveling with other schools, whether you want to or not, particularly with EF. My sister-in-law manages the grand tour for her school in Georgia, and she uses the EF service, but they're always lumped in with other schools from around the country that they don't know who, and so her ability to hire her own tour guides and her ability to guide the discussion and manage the group is taken away from her. So I just would prefer not to do that. I like to make these arrangements myself so that I have, maybe I'm a control freak, but I just like to have all these things controlled myself. What about doing it yourself? What are some of the pros and cons of doing it yourself? Well, the pros are you have ultimate flexibility. You can go where you want, when you want. You're in charge. You control the quality of your tour guides. If you don't like them, you won't hire them again next year. So the tour guides are completely at your disposal. You're the master of your itinerary. You know, if I one of the things I do as we're traveling from Assisi to Siena, we pass Lake Trasimeno, and there was a famous Punic war battle there. And so we stop, and Ralph Janikowski gives a presentation on the Punic war battle of Lake Trasimeno. If somebody else hired the bus company, I wouldn't be able to say, hey, stop for 20 minutes. We want to visit this lake. That would be someone else's call, and I wouldn't be able to make it. So I do like the ability to be able to make all these calls myself. What are the cons of planning it yourself? It's a lot of work. Okay, when I get back to Millersville this afternoon, next week I'll wrap up report cards. I'll start planning next year's grand tour. Well, I've kind of already started doing it. While I was in Italy, while I was in Greece and Italy, I started making reservations at hotels for next year, saying, pencil me in, pencil me in. So I was going to say I'm going to start doing that when I get back, but I've already started doing it. So it's just a continuous cycle of work. It's a lot of work. All right, let's talk about pacing. As Ralph is wont to say, rest is a weapon. Use it. You have to build in periods of rest in your grand tour. You're going to want to be constantly on the run because there's always something more wonderful to see around the corner. But you have to guard yourself against that. There have to be built-in periods of rest. I schedule our itinerary so that our first Sunday is spent on a boat traveling from Greece to Italy so that there's nothing to do but essentially rest. We have worship on board. We use the movie theater. It's a serviceable room for us to have worship in. And then we spend the day on the boat. It's kind of forced rest. So plan your rests carefully. What kind of attention can you expect from your students? I would say maximum 4 hours a day. To have them standing on their feet, listening, taking notes, engaged, asking questions in a foreign environment. I would say four hours a day max, maybe even less as you get closer to the end when they're really tired. What about transportation? If you've got a group of probably more than six students, you're going to have to use a travel agency for your airline tickets because airlines generally don't deal with groups of more than six people. So if you're any larger than that, you have to go to a travel agency to get your airline tickets. By land, I hire our own bus companies to pick us up wherever we go. It would be nice. There's a certain romance about using a train to get from Rome to Assisi. That's a wonderful thing. But when you get to Assisi and your hotel is a mile and a half away and you've got 25 people with their baggage and they're tired, then what do you do? Okay? Taxi services in Assisi aren't really like they are in Rome, so you'll all be standing there for an hour while the one cab in town takes all of you back and forth to your hotel. It's much easier just to say to the bus, here's the address of the hotel. Pick us up at this one in Rome, drop us up at that one in Assisi, bang, we're done. So hire bus services to do that. We as I said, we also take the ferry from Greece and Italy, and we make all those arrangements ourselves. All right, let's talk about funding the Grand Tour, because I know that's what you're really interested in the first place. The main thing you need to do is, once you've decided this is our itinerary, this is where we want to go, this is how long we want to stay there, you need to estimate the cost of your itinerary. You can get quotes from hotels, so you'll know what the per-night cost there is going to be. The Internet is a wonderful thing. You visit the Archaeological Museum in Athens, and there you find out how much it costs for an admission ticket. So you know what you're going – once you have your itinerary planned, you know where you're going to go, what you're going to want to do when you get there. Now you begin to price it out. So you determine a cost. This is what it's going to cost. Number of students, number of chaperones, and the per diem costs for the chaperones. Take a look at the second handout I've given to you in this regard. It's called the expense worksheet. Everybody have that? You'll see there across the top the dates of our trip. The item, is it an airfare, is it a tour guide, is it a museum site, what is it? And then the particular vendor, what the cost is. So there's the total cost. So this year the total cost of our trip was around $160,000. The exchange rates, I can monitor what the cost is in actual dollars. And then the Excel sheet divides that out into a per-person cost. So roughly the cost per person based on this itinerary, $3,440.46, roughly. So there I have my itinerary, everything that I as the group am going to touch, and what that's going to cost in total, and what that breaks down to person. Okay? Where does the money come from? Now I think we're getting at the heart of what people want to talk about. Where does the money come from to pay for the Grand Tour? Well, there are several options you've got available to you. You can pay as you go. In other words, you just say to your class, we're going on this tour, it's going to cost $3,400, and you all individually have to come up with that money. Well, the problem there is they're already paying X thousands of dollars in tuition. If they've got more than one child in the school, multiply that by however many kids they have. It's not easy to come up with, you know, an additional $4,000 to go on the trip, on the grand tour. It's just not easy. I know some schools who do that. To buffer that, maybe they do some fundraising. And they'll tell the kids you can go out throughout the course of the year and you can have your car wash and your bake sale and your hot lunch and your so on and so forth. And then pool the money together, spread that out among the student body who's going, and now you only have to raise $2,400 a piece in order to go. Well, that's easier, but it's still probably going to eliminate some of your students. And you really want all of them to go. I think that's key. You want this to be a class event. You want all the students to go. You could include it in your tuition. This is the option that Rockbridge has chosen. We include a portion of the student's tuition. We set it aside in a grand tour fund. It's not much, but over time it accumulates, and that's the vehicle through which we fund the student's portion. Now, let me say this. The parents have to pay. Okay, if the parents want to come along, it's wonderful to have them, but they have to pay. But the students are covered as part of their tuition. And we'll talk in a little bit more detail how to do that. As I said, you could fundraise if you want to. We personally don't like to send our students out fundraising. Their work is hard enough. Their schedule is hard enough with the level of academic work they have to do. Add into that a lacrosse practice, a basketball, a soccer, a musical, whatever. They really don't have time to be going out and fundraising on top of that, so we don't ask them to do that. You could do some combination of all three of these. What Rockbridge does is we reserve a portion of every student's tuition, and we set that little portion aside each month. In the initial years as we were doing this, we set aside more than we needed because we knew, as I said, our first class of seniors was 5 boys. Our second class was 4 girls. Then it went up to about 7 and then 10. And then we had 2 sections of 11th graders that bumped it up to about 24. So we went from 10 to about 24. And we didn't want that bump to be a surprise. We didn't want to get hit out of the blue with that. So we started to build the reserve in advance. Take a look at the second handout I have for you. This breaks it down into a little more detail how we do that. For example, in the year 2009-10, you can see that on your handout, the fourth column, annual dollars per student, $214 per student is set aside, $21.40 a month over the 10 months of the payments cycle. When you break it down like that, that seems relatively doable, doesn't it? $21 a month, $214 a year. If you set your tuition, let's say your tuition for your school was $7,500, would $7,714 that push people over the brink that they wouldn't come back, particularly if they knew that $214 was going towards making Grand Tour a normal part of school culture? I don't know that would be your call, but I don't know that would be a backbreaker to set that, to build that in, let parents know it's built in, and this is what the $214 is going to be used for. So as you look across the columns, you can see the number of rising seniors, the cost of the trip per person, the total cost, the deficit, the excess of the deficit, and the total accrual balance. So that's how we do it. We want to make every student able to go, and so we set aside a piece of their tuition to accomplish that purpose. So the objective, as I said, is to avoid budget shocks as a larger class comes along. You estimate the number of students and chaperones over the next 5 to 10 years. You track this. And then estimate the cost per year with allowances for inflation. This year, actually, because of the economic crisis going on in Europe, particularly in Greece and Italy, the exchange rate was wonderful. We had planned, you know, we typically plan for about a 4% increase in the cost of the trip each year. We didn't see anywhere near that, and the exchange rate was much more favorable to us. So then you build a chart like this to help you figure this out for your school. In year one, the number of dollars to be set aside for the grand tour, let's say, is $50,000. The estimated cost for the grand tour is going to be $40,000. That means you have $10,000 set aside in your excess fund. Okay. The next year, you want to set aside $55,000, and the cost of the trip is going to be $45,000. You got another $10,000 in your fund. Now the grand tour balance is $20,000. Third year, you're going to set aside $60,000, and the cost of the trip is $60,000. So you're at a net wash there, but you've still got $20,000 in your fund. What can you do with that $20,000 in the next year? Well, now you can start dipping into it. And you and your business manager and your board, you manage this fund so that it kind of levels out as the size of your classes level out. Okay? Let's talk about emergencies. Planning. You can't just get on a plane and go. You have to. Most of your students are not going to be experienced travelers. You have to give them a heads up. Parents, too. I'll tell you what. I have my grand tour class with just 1 hour a week. And I spend that year dialing the kids in, making sure they understand the history, the art, the architecture, the itinerary, what a typical day looks like, what kind of shoes to wear, how to avoid theft and pickpocketing and all sorts of things. Well, who's not in that class? Parents are not in that class. And I might have one or two meetings with the parents throughout the course of the year. Some of them may or may not come. And so typically, when I get on the ground in Europe, it's not the kids giving me, is grief too hard a word, giving me a hard time. Sometimes it's the parents who weren't there for my constant reminder. Don't walk away from the group. So as part of the grand tour class, as I said, I cover the history. I want them to have a capstone of the history, cover the art, the architecture, the different styles of art and architecture they're going to be seeing, and how they can recognize it as part of that particular history's culture. You know, if they see a rigid statue with two fists clenched at each side, this little Mona Lisa sort of smile, we know we're looking, and very, very rigid sort of hair and so forth, we know we're looking at Kouros, right. We're looking at archaic Greece and so forth. So I want them to fairly readily recognize those sorts of things as they go along. I also cover things like how do we unload this bus efficiently so that we're not tied up on the side of the road at the hotel for a half an hour while everybody climbs over one another to get their own piece of luggage, you know, organizing a little fire brigade. Every little detail, just to help us move from A to B to Z efficiently, I try to think ahead and go over that stuff with them because they're not familiar with traveling in groups of 45 people in foreign countries. As I said, I go over pickpocketing strategies, and I tell them this is not to make you afraid. This is to make you traveling wisely so that you don't need to be afraid. Follow these basic principles, and then you won't have to be constantly looking over your shoulder or on guard. I even address with them how to flush toilets in Italy, because there are so many different varieties of toilets to flush in Italy. I've had people come out and go, I couldn't figure out how to flush it, and I couldn't figure out how to make the water run. So my hands are full of soap. What do I do? You don't want people to be surprised. I don't let kids go off in groups of smaller than four, and of those four, one of them has to be a young man. And again, they may not be able to do that in the larger cities, Rome or Athens, particularly in Athens, since we land there and they don't even have their sea legs yet. But I manage their how they go off with one another. Usually what I do, as soon as we get to a location, I'll take them for a walk. And I'll make sure they're oriented. Here's where the hotel is. Here's where that major monument is. Here's where the metro is. And then we come back. We go to the hotel. And now they at least have a feel. If they do get separated, at least they have a feel for where things are and how to get back to the hotel. Several pieces of information I require everyone to keep on them at all times. Everybody must hold their own passports. Sometimes when you have moms on the trip, mom wants to hold Junior's passport for him just so he doesn't lose it. But when that happens, it's going to happen that Junior and mom don't go together someday, and it's at that particular moment that somebody's going to require Junior's passport of him, and mom has it, and that's when you're going to get into a difficulty. He won't be able to get into the museum or whatever. So everybody has to carry their own passport. Before we leave, I get everybody's cell phone numbers, who's going to be bringing his cell phone to Europe. I have that printed on a little piece of paper and fed back to everybody so that everybody has everybody's cell phone numbers, along with hotel addresses and phone numbers, meeting places every day so that if you do get separated, you know where to go. And then they're required to carry this little postcard on them at all times. I always have the embassy and consulate numbers on me. Everybody else doesn't need that, but if somebody loses a passport, I need to know where to go so that if I have to get a passport replaced, we do that sort of thing. I keep copies of everybody's passports because that makes that easier to replace if they do get lost. I also keep copies of their airline tickets, but I hold the airline tickets. As soon as we get to Athens or as soon as we get to our destination, I gather all the airline tickets back from everybody, and I keep those for the rest of the trip. And then when we are leaving, I distribute them again so that there's no chance that somebody's airline ticket is going to get lost. Travel insurance, I typically leave that up to the individuals to take care of for themselves. But this year, with volcanoes in Iceland and riots in Greece 3 weeks before we were getting ready to leave, troubling me, I'm going to rethink that, purchasing travel insurance for the group in the past and the future. So I'm still investigating whether to do that in the future, because you never know what's going to happen, right? That's the whole point of insurance. Well, I wanted to leave time for questions, and I think we have about 10 minutes or so to do that. Do you have any questions for me? Yes, sir. Okay. The question is about safety procedures for me, particularly in regards to the airline tickets. I have them in my suitcase, and my suitcase is locked in my hotel room wherever I go. I used to leave them in hotel safes. I think that was a little overkill on my part. And then the one time when I actually left them in the hotel safe and left the city, caused no small amount of Sturm und Drang for me. So I don't do that anymore. I just keep them with me in the suitcase. But as long as I have the airline tickets and copies of them in a separate place, so that if I lost a whole bunch of airline tickets, as long as I have those confirmation numbers with me and I can present that to the airline at some point, I'm good.
Do I pay for all the meals?
No. Breakfast is included every day, and about half of the dinners are included. But I want people to go out and explore. So I give everybody a little travel log that has recommendations from me, and I upgrade that each year. I say, but you know, the best thing to do, just go out and explore and walk around and find something. That's included in the cost, yep. If you look at the sheet I gave you, the expense worksheet, you'll see meal in there with the hotel. Yes, I'm sorry, go ahead. I don't. Typically the meals that are included are dinners in hotels, so it's already paid for with the hotel bill. The question was, if I collect money for meals, how do I dole it back out again? I don't do that. I don't dole money back out. The meals that are included with the hotels, which I pay for most of the time before I leave this country. Yes, their expense money includes their lunches and whatever meals are not included in the trip. That's a good question. What do they pay for? They pay for anything they want to do that's not included in my itinerary. So if they want to, on their free morning in Rome, go to see the Villa Borghese, that's on them. If they know that they're going to, that I only cover about half the dinners, so that on this day it's covered, on this day it's not, it's on them. And all that information is included in the travelogue that I give them, so there's really no questions. The last thing I want is for people to be traveling in a foreign country going, where in the world am I and what am I supposed to be doing? I really want to avoid that at all costs. Somebody had a question here. Nope. Yes, ma'am. Okay, the question is, if I'm including the cost in tuition, do I then hand out expense money? No. The cost, what comes out of the student's tuition is everything that I plan for them to do. So it's everything from the tip for the bus driver in Italy to the airline tickets to get us there. Everything that I, as the tour leader, am planning for them to do that they must do. So if they go off on their own, they know that lunch is on me. They know that that really nice leather jacket in Florence is on me. They know that Vivoli's ice cream is on me, or is on them. And so they know exactly what I'm paying for, and they know exactly what they're paying for. And then I tell them, plan on about $650 to $700 in spending money. Yes, ma'am. Okay, good question. The question is about the money that's set aside from their tuition. Is it, yes, it's K through 12, so $214. And that amount changes from year to year because, remember, I'm managing this fund. I don't want it to have real high peaks and low valleys. I want to try to level out. So let's just pick a number and say $214 per student. That's per year, and that money is getting set aside. $21 of their monthly tuition payment is getting set aside in this grantor fund from the time they're in kindergarten through the time they're in 12th grade. What about if they enter in the 5th grade? To be honest with you, I start doing the same thing for them. It's like anything else they might take advantage of. You know, their tuition goes to pay for orchestra, let's say, or soccer program. Do I charge them more and prorate that because they came in at 5th grade rather than from kindergarten? No, I just call it a day. What if somebody comes in the 10th grade? I might charge them, at that point, I might charge them a little bit more. I had a student come in this year at 11th grade. So she'd only been in the school 1 year. She was a foreign exchange student from China. I made her pay because she was never able to set aside anything into this trip. So that would have been like giving her a free trip. So I told her parents, if you want her to come along, the whole fee is on you as if you were a parent paying. So. No, I don't have individual student accounts for everybody at school, but I try to understand that while I'm looking at the group as an aggregate as a whole, I still have to consider that I have individuals here. And so if a student drops into school in 11th grade, a very rare thing, I would make that student pay for the trip. If somebody came in 9th grade, I'd probably call it a day and say, okay, it all comes out in the wash anyway. One thing I do require if a student doesn't come back in their senior year, goes on the trip and then doesn't re-enroll in their senior year, they pay me for that trip because they've just taken advantage of an educational opportunity that then can't be built upon in their senior year, and they sign a legal waiver prior to going, committing to doing that. Yes, ma'am. Okay. The question is, how do I decide what faculty members to use? Well, they pay me handsomely, and then no, it's not a bribe system. I look at a number of different factors. Do they have children going themselves? Okay. You know how it is to work in a Christian school. You're not making money hand over fist. And so to say to Mrs. Smith, whose son is in the 11th grade and is going, Mr. and Mrs. Smith, yeah, if you want to go, it's, you know, it's $4,500 or whatever. That's a lot for our teachers who don't make much. So I try to look at, okay, who's got a child going and would be interested in going. I also look at what are they teaching? What's the bang for the buck back into the program as a result of this teacher going? Denise Hollidge, for example, one of my teachers over here, has gone, and she teaches third grade. But she teaches ancient Greek history and Greek and Roman history in third grade. So it was a great investment for Denise to take part in that. And she went when her daughter Anna was going, so it was a real blessing to her. I have more teachers who would want to go than I can take. But I would love to bless all of them with this opportunity over the course of the years. Yes, ma'am, in the back. The question is, if I have other teachers who want to go and their parents, can they just pay to go? Yeah, had that happen this year. I had, how many faculty did we have on the trip this year? We had four, right? And so there were three faculty along who were just paying parents. They were not chaperones, so that does happen. Yes, sir. Okay, the question is the time with the curriculum. When does this begin? Does it begin in 9th, 10th, or just in 11th grade? Actually, it begins, I would say, in kindergarten. We might have an oral presentation or to the young kids and begin give the kindergartner's vision. The second graders study ancient Egyptian history, ancient history. We might do a presentation for them. I personally will go into Denise's class, since she teaches Greek and Roman history, and give them, here's the things Mrs. Hollidge has taught you. Here are the things that you'll be seeing on the grand tour to give you a greater vision for what Mrs. Hollidge has been teaching you about ancient Greek and Roman culture. I would say we look at opportunities to tie it back in across the board. It doesn't begin in 11th grade. Yes, ma'am. Okay, the question is about the 1 hour per week class that I have. It's during elective period, but the juniors are required to take it. So it's not really their elective. It's kind of a mandatory elective. And, you know, 1 hour a week is not much, but I try to cover all the essentials that I can in the course of the year. Am I answering your question? Yeah. The juniors... No, it's a class during the course of the day. The last period of the day, the way we have our schedule, is the elective period. That's when PE, choir, debate, et cetera, and so forth are going on. Those are the elective periods. But the juniors know that their Tuesday elective is me, is Grand Tour class. They don't have an opportunity to... We have two different kinds of electives, a Monday, Wednesday, Friday elective and a Tuesday, Thursday elective. And so in 11th grade, we've tailored it so that they know that on Tuesday, they've got my Grand Tour class, and on Thursday, they've got study hall or Mr. Janikowski's seminar and ideas class. Other questions? Yes, ma'am. Yes, ma'am. Yes, if you look at that sheet, there's interest in there, and the buffer is included so that as I collect the money, I have a balance in excess of what I need.
Okay.
Yeah, the question is about legal waivers and should there be an emergency. Yes, I have parents sign off on a legal waiver that includes, if you don't come back in the senior year, you're gonna pay me the cost of the trip, and gives me permission to seek medical care should they have an emergency and those sorts of things. So, yeah, all my parents have to sign that. Yeah, the question is about money at mealtimes. I don't tell them, here's what you're allowed to spend. I say, go, plan on this much, but it's really up to you. If you want to go gangbusters and get the best meal in town. Oh, these are meals that you were included in your trip. I see. Yes, I do. But generally speaking, I remind our kids, don't forget, because kids generally forget, tips, taxes, that sort of thing. So I remind them ahead of time. I want to ask you a question before I run out of time. People have asked me in the past, would I ever be willing to do a sort of a shortened grand tour just for teachers who are interested in bringing this back to their schools and just like taking a week and in the summer and having you come along with me, and this is what we do, sort of running the grand tour with you. How many of you have any interest in that whatsoever? 1, 2, 3... Okay, well, if you have interest in that, come to our table, our book table. It's just around the way there, Rockbridge Academy. Leave your name and number with my lovely assistants that are there, and we'll see if that's something that has legs and can take some fruition. Last question over here. Yes, ma'am. Do you want me to say anything about it, or you just want to look at it? Okay, gaze away. All right, well, thank you for your kind attention. I appreciate it. I hope this has been valuable for you, and thank you. Enjoy the rest of your conference.